Speech and communication is a fundamental and necessary part of our days. My job depends on me being able to articulate the news every morning in a way that you, the listener, will understand. But how hard is it to correct or relearn this intrinsic skill? I'm Maria Carter, and on this Central Standard, we are looking at speech therapy, how it adapts speech motor skills, changes cognitive impairments with speech, and the different types of patients that require this therapy. And later, we meet the Emporia State Debate Team that used their speech skills to win the National Debate Tournament and Cross-Examination Debate Association Tournament, the first team to ever achieve both titles. That's all ahead after this hour's news. Good morning. This hour is all about speech. Later in the hour, we'll talk with two local college debaters about how they won two national tournaments, a first. But before that, we're talking about those who may be having a little more trouble expressing themselves. For years during elementary school, I visited Mrs. Adair's office twice a week. We played lots of games and read stories, but they all involved a certain sound. For me, it was mostly S's. I had a lisp. And today I'm joined by Dr. Carol Koch. Good morning, Carol.
Good morning.
And Shatonda Jones. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And they help people with lisps and other speech disorders. They're both speech language pathologists from Rockhurst University. How do you define what a speech disorder is?
Good question. In speech pathology, we really look at several areas: language, speech, cognition or cognitive linguistic skills, so things like memory, processing speed, attention, and then dysphagia. And so in the definition, like if we were specifically thinking about speech, we would be thinking about the production of language, so how your brain sends the signals to your muscles to actually produce the sound. So when you said like the lisp, how does the brain actually communicate to your muscles in your face, your lips, your tongue to do that S sound? And language, more so how your brain says, hey, that's a cat. I want to say the word cat. And so that's how we kind of look at it. We define them in several different areas.
Well, and what do you do as a speech pathologist or a speech therapist?
I specifically work with adults who have neurogenic communication disorders, so people that have sustained strokes, traumatic brain injuries, cancers. And what I do is work on those language areas. We have several different games, worksheets, activities. We try to keep it nice and functional to return those people back to their previous standard of living or quality of life. But there's a lot of different things that we use.
And Carol, what do you do?
My primary professional background is with children, and I've worked with children as young as 6 months and all the way up through school age. I work with children who are in the schools who have difficulty communicating because of articulation problems or phonological problems, or perhaps some language problems where they're having difficulty accurately communicating the messages that they want to communicate, but also working with young children as young as 6 months who have identified disorders that put them at risk for developing communication disorders or delays.
And what are some of those disorders?
Cleft lip and cleft palate, children on the autism spectrum, children with hearing loss or deafness that can be identified at birth, children with Down syndrome.
And so identifying those things early to help them gain those language skills, is that the key there?
Yes, that's a system that we call early intervention for children birth to 3. And what we try to do is work with them early enough to help them maximize their potential so that the delays that they might demonstrate are minimized as they get older.
And when you have a young child, you know, you mentioned as young as 6 months old, but maybe a toddler or a school-age kid as well, who is the person that usually brings this up as something to be on the lookout for, or, you know, might recommend them to yourself or someone else?
Typically, the parent has areas of concern. They've been watching and observing, and they're expecting to see certain skills. And when they don't see those skills, they become concerned. Sometimes they may talk to their pediatrician about that, but then some parents may just contact a speech-language pathologist directly for consultation or perhaps even an assessment to determine if there is a delay or a disorder.
And when should a parent become concerned, or what are some of those signs that they should be on the lookout for?
Well, I would say that just as a general guideline, children have their own developmental progressions, but generally if a child babbles around 5 to 6 months, begins changing the sounds that they use as they babble, they're experimenting with their sounds and how to make those sounds, and first words typically occur around 12 months. And children then begin combining those words as they build their vocabulary. They begin combining words between 18 to 24 months. So if some of those milestones aren't reached, I always encourage parents to seek the advice of a speech-language pathologist. The good news might be that they're just within a normal range of development, but it could be that they are demonstrating a delay, that the earlier we can target those skills that they might be deficient in demonstrating, the earlier we target them, the more likely that they can achieve the skills that they need to be demonstrating at those ages.
And Shatonda, you work with adults. Where do you get your referrals from?
Usually, our referrals come from the primary care physicians. A lot of times, our patients have had strokes or those brain injuries, and they're in the hospital, and so the doctors or the physicians will just kind of notice that there's a difficulty. So they go in, they round on them, and then they decide that, you know, we need to have speech pathology consulted. And so we get our consults, and then from that point, we get to do our evaluations and then, you know, do the treatment if we feel it's necessary. But there are some people that do recognize that they have difficulties, and specifically I think about those people with mild traumatic brain injuries, so people that are immediately post-concussion, like a mild concussion. Sometimes they really do go home and go to work and go to school and realize that they're having some difficulties that maybe, you know, are so mild that it's hard to see in just, you know, everyday normal day-to-day activities. But when you go and go to work and have to actually, you know, organize and remember things, it's just harder than it was before the brain injury. And so sometimes we'll go like self-referrals from those guys.
I was just thinking of Gabrielle Giffords, who, you know, it was the congresswoman who was shot in the head and,
yes,
you know, suffered brain injury, and that she was working on her speech.
Yes.
Is that, you know, someone that you would work with, for example?
Absolutely. She had a brilliant speech pathologist that worked with her. And again, it was when she went to the hospital, the physicians realized that because of her injury and because of where her injury was, that she would need speech pathology services. And so the speech pathologist, along with a few other therapists, worked with her to help regain some of that language.
And how does that process with maybe the medical doctor work? Is it an interaction? Is the speech therapy healing their brain, or does their brain have to heal first?
You know, it's kind of, in rehabilitation, we like to think about it that the brain is naturally going to start to heal itself. It's just going to happen. What we do is we help enhance that healing just by getting in there really early, starting some of those tasks to kind of maximize the gains that the brain could make on its own.
So like physical therapy a little bit for the brain.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You mentioned trying to keep it fun. What are some of the activities that you might do with someone that shows up and is needing some help?
In rehabilitation, we like to keep things nice and fun and also functional. So our main goal is to make sure that what we do in therapy really mirrors what the person has to do in real life. And so I know some of the activities that I've done personally. I've taken people grocery shopping. We've gone on other outings. We play games. Like, it's interesting, and especially with the advent of the iPad, you can pull the iPad out, and all the games on there have a cognitive feature to them. You can play those games, and then a lot of our patients are like, hey, we're not really doing therapy, but they're having to use those problem-solving and reasoning skills, and it becomes like you're doing this therapy, but you're really not – you're doing therapy without feeling like you're doing therapy.
And I know when I was a student, going to speech therapy was one of my favorite classes just because it was a break. I did get to play games and kind of have fun. How do you use that with the younger students?
Well, the context of play is how children learn. So the toys that we use make that context fun, but we intentionally set up opportunities to elicit the skills that we're working on. So if there are specific speech sounds that the child is working on, we make sure that the activity provides them multiple opportunities to utilize the new sounds that they're learning, or to utilize the vocabulary that they're trying to learn and add to their skill set.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on kcur.org. I'm Maria Carter. Our guests are Dr. Carol Koch and Chitanda Jones. They're both speech-language pathologists from Rockhurst University, and we're talking today about speech disorders, their treatments, and challenges. Has a speech disorder affected your life? Did you get treatment? What worked best for you? Join the conversation by calling 816-235-2888 or 816-235-2888. Email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Thinking about the different types of speech disorders out there, it seems like there are a number, you know, from not being able to pronounce certain sounds to, you know, stuttering or stammering to a whole bunch of others I was looking at. Does treatment vary quite a bit from one type of disorder to the next?
Yes, it does. It all depends on what the person is dealing with. So how you would treat a speech production deficit, let's say like a dysarthria. So that's, again, one of those deficits that's the brain having issues communicating with the muscles and producing the sounds. We would treat that much differently than we would, say, like a cognitive impairment, which would be something like memory. Although the treatments may vary, the overall goal for us would be the same, and that's to return to some kind of quality of life.
And with students, do you play different sorts of games do different sorts of plays for different disorders?
Yes. If we are working on speech sounds, then the way that we play the game might be different than if we are trying to help a child learn how to combine words into phrases and sentences. And it's also different if we are working on verbal communication, or perhaps we've got a child who is not able to be verbal and we're teaching them a different way to communicate, either with pictures or with a device that has voice output. So that changes how we work with children.
And I know a friend of mine has a child or two children who are autistic, and she is a big fan of iPads and what they can do to help, you know, children with autism and autism spectrum disorders communicate. How are those used?
Well, there are lots of ways that you can use them with children on the autism spectrum, from learning how to script stories to planning their day for a visual schedule where they know that they're going to do this activity, and then they'll do another activity, and then they'll get a break and they get to play a game or something like that. So, and then all of the applications that are language rich, there's just so much that you can do.
Okay, and we have a caller. Good morning to Victoria from Overland Park.
Good morning. Great show. I did have speech therapy when I was like in first grade. When I said R, it sounded like aw. And I couldn't hear the difference. And when I would go home and do my practice, my siblings encouraged me because they'd love to laugh at me saying, wound a wugged walk, the wagged wask was weighing. And it sounded like I was saying it correctly. Thankfully, it was taken care of. But I have two a lovely family next door to me, and I'm just curious. Their teenage son and their younger son have the same sounds that I made with a R, aw thing. And when is it too late for someone to get treatment for that, to be able to correct that?
I would say that that's a really good question, and it's not ever too late to change speech sound patterns. And some of the strategies and the ways that we work with teenagers and adults would be different than the way we work with children, but certainly it is not too late for them to identify that those sounds are in error and they'd like to make some changes and learn how to make those sounds correctly.
Yeah, it's sensitive. I don't know if you have. I've never broached the subject except obliquely, you know, when Mom talked about, you know, the kids being bullied. And, you know, my assumption is that they've had therapy, but I just, you know, don't press it because they're good parents. So I just feel for the kids.
Well, thank you for your call, Victoria. Yeah,
thank you.
She mentioned R's. I think S's are another common one. Are there just certain sounds that are hard for people to say?
Yes, R's and L's and S's tend to be very common amongst school-age children, older elementary children. One of the things that contributes to that is that they're hard to see. They're not as visual as some of our other sounds, so it's hard to see how to make those sounds. And children learn about making speech sounds from what they can hear, but also from what they can see for how the adults and other communication partners make those sounds when they're young.
So the S being, as I used to do it with my tongue out, you know, that's something you could see, but you can't see it being behind the teeth.
That's correct.
I've always kind of wondered this. Are there different sounds that are hard? I know that, like, are there sounds that are specifically hard for different languages? Does speech therapy differ if you're, you know, in Spain or in another country where a different language is being spoken? Do you know?
I don't know as much about that.
Yeah.
But my guess is that that there are difficult sounds in other languages and that there are developmental guidelines for when children acquire sounds in other languages and that they have those set of sounds that are difficult just like we do in English.
And you work with adults, so you might be a little more do you get people who or have colleagues who get people that are from a different country that now want to improve their English and are working on doing some of those sounds that maybe aren't in their language?
Yes. Speech pathologists, we work a lot with accent modification. And all that is we're not trying to take away their accents, but if they elect to have services, maybe they want to work on the sound system of English. Maybe it's for work or for school or just, you know, for overall, I just want to do this. And so we will work on certain sounds. And like Carol said, those sounds that are more difficult to see are much harder for them than the sounds that are easier to visualize.
I had a friend in college who was applying to PhD programs and was basically told to be more successful, she should see a speech therapist to stop talking like a valley girl. they said it slightly more nicely, but that was the gist of it. Do you get those sorts of clients who maybe want to just change the tone of how they're speaking and, what we might think of as an accent or just an intonation even?
I personally don't work with those clients very often, but we do. Some of the principles are the same, but the way that we think about therapy with those folks that elect to have more of an accent modification, we don't think of it as therapy. It's more kind of problem solving, trying to help you be successful in the area that you're trying to go into. So I'm thinking as a PhD student, she's probably going to have to teach. And so her accent may affect her ability to communicate with her students. And so we would think more of it as a consultant or a coaching type situation where maybe the speech pathologist would come in and watch her teach a course and kind of help give her some strategies how to make that more efficient and then really would get in there and work with the sounds.
And the previous caller that we had, she mentioned R's. I was thinking she would have fit in well with my cousin's family from Boston, who we used to make say aardvark all the time, just because she didn't say R's. How much of that is regional as far as what is considered normal?
In the United States, we have several areas that we call dialect regions, and that they're influenced by some of the languages that settled in those areas, but there are regional dialects that are perfectly acceptable and identified variations of our language.
And so if she'd been in Boston, would she have seen, been referred to the speech therapist maybe in first grade? Or would that just have been considered maybe part of the normal accent?
Very likely it would have been determined to be just part of the dialect that is utilized in that area.
Chantal, you work a lot with people that have maybe recently developed, a speech disorder or,
yes,
you know, gone through some traumatic experience that leaves their speech impaired. What are some of the difficulties of that?
You know, I think a lot of times with our adults, it's going from a situation of usually being pretty functional, being able to communicate, work, engage with family without any difficulty, and then going to this position of, well, now I can't speak, or now thinking is harder. I think a lot of what we do is help to counsel them about what this impairment actually means and with their lives. And when there's a lot of anxiety about what's going on, like communication-wise, we also will refer to psychology and have psychology step in to work with some of those adjustment emotional issues. But a lot of times that's the big thing, like just trying to get over that, you know, this happened to you and we're going to work really hard to get you back to as far as we can to your normal. But that's huge.
That I mean, part. I think we've all struggled to find a word or, you know, the phrase that we're looking for. And it's very frustrating. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine what that might be like on a daily basis to have that pop up or, you know, just not being able to get your thoughts out there.
Right. I think that's an absolutely great comment. I mean, how many times have we all, like, you're in a job interview and you're trying to say the word yes and it's coming out everything but yes. I just kind of think of it for those people that have aphasia, which is a language impairment. That's their daily lives for a lot of them. A lot of them really just can't get those words out. And so for some, like there's a few different types of aphasia. For some of those folks, they recognize that they can't say the word and it becomes incredibly frustrating. Whereas other people that have aphasia don't recognize it at all. And so they continue down that path of producing the wrong word or having trouble with understanding what's coming in. And they have to have a lot of cues, which then becomes frustrating when you constantly get told, I don't understand you. I don't understand you. That gets frustrating. So it's frustrating on all ends.
Do people ever, I remember a David Sedaris story where he talked about his lisp and how he kind of basically worked around saying any word that had an S in it. And do you guys see that in your clients?
Well, absolutely. They learn the things that are hard and they will develop strategies to avoid those hard situations, whether it's a speech sound or a word or a concept, and develop strategies around to try to still effectively communicate their message.
We have an email. Janelle writes, my grandmother has had several strokes which affected her speech. She has undergone speech therapy for years. As part of recovery, my daughter would read to her. We would also call her to engage in conversation. This worked very well for her at the time. Unfortunately, she has had more strokes and speech therapy is no longer an option. And she's wondering how and when do they decide to give up treatment on that? Shatonda?
You know, a lot of times when people stop making gains, and that's a hard thing to say because I don't personally believe that we ever stop making progress. But what happens is progress slows down and there are some limitations to what we can do when we kind of have that kind of plateau of progress. Really, what you can do is continue what you've been doing. Even though you can't have speech therapy, it's not like grandma can't engage with her granddaughter with the reading or just being a part of the family. So when there's conversations going on, I think Janelle has done absolutely the right thing. Continue to have grandma as part of those conversations. There's also other community organizations that maybe you can't have that one-on-one speech therapy, but what does work is getting grandma out, if she's mobile and able to participate, but getting out and mingling with other people that have had strokes and really understand.
So it sounds like doing some of those things that maybe you've already learned how to do as part of her therapy, just keeping those up,
yes,
even if she's not formally part of it.
Even if you can't make gains, we like to think about maintenance as well. And in speech pathology, we can't do one-on-one therapy just for maintenance. We do it to make progress. But a lot of what we do, we really lean on our families. We get people for 1 hour a day, maybe 3 to 5 times a week. And so the other however many hours in that week, we really ask our families to really get involved. And so the speech pathologist may train you on a home program and say, hey, these are the activities I need you to do. Or it could be as simply as, you know, I'm not going to give you anything formal, but just communicate with them.
And Sandy asks, what websites and resources to use in stroke treatments and if there are any apps in particular that are good?
There are a few apps, depending on what's going on. So if it's an expression issue, which means, you know, you're having trouble saying the words, it can be a reception issue, meaning that you're having trouble understanding directions. But there are a few apps on the iPad. My best advice, because there are a lot more than a few, would be to just in the little search browser, type in speech therapy and it will pull up like thousands. You know, some of them are better than others, but they all have some benefit to them. Otherwise, you know, like I said, the community organizations are really great too.
And is that the same for the children?
Yes, I would agree with that. And I would suggest as a website to go to for just overall information about communication disorders, it would be www.asha.org. And there's a wealth of information for families, caregivers, clients, people who are concerned about communication. There's all kinds of information available.
And what organization is that for?
That's the American Speech Language Hearing Association, our national association.
And is that a good place for people to go to maybe find someone if they think someone they either have a problem or someone they love might have a problem and need therapy?
That's certainly one source. And then there are lots of local sources and physicians in the area that can also help direct families to speech language pathologists.
It seems like there are almost two branches here. It feels like where it's the younger people and then the, older patients or adult patients. But you use a lot of the same techniques, it sounds like. Is there some difference in how you work with these patients or these? No.
No, because they utilize the same systems to communicate. It's just the nature of the communication disorder and the context in which we work with the patients.
And then also kind of thinking about like the outcomes, like I guess with pediatrics, we're thinking about getting to school. With adults, we may be thinking more about getting back to work and managing family responsibilities. Mm-hmm. And so I think that would be the only difference. But again, like Carol said, we it's the same system.
Okay. And Herman asks in an email, I'm bilingual, Chinese and English growing up. I went to speech classes. It sounds like I have the same problems with sounds. I've read that knowing another language helps slow dementia. Are there studies into teaching another language when helping autistic children or other types of speech impairment?
Good question. Slowing dementia, there's a lot of recent research about that. Any time that as younger people we engage in activities that help our cognitive processes, so thinking about memory, it's almost like that whole use it or lose it thing. We want to continue to build those cognition or cognitive processes. And so no one can predict whether or not you will actually slow your dementia. There's some research that says potentially, but we're so individual that there are other risk factors involved that may say, you know, you can do everything right in the world and you still may develop dementia.
Well, and do you ever have students who their parents say, well, they don't have a problem communicating in one language, but even though they know the words maybe in English, they're not getting them out as they should? Or do you face that problem?
With younger children, we do have children who are native language speakers of one language and they're trying to acquire a second language. And so one of the challenges we have when there are concerns in one or both languages is determining which language that they might have some delays or deficits or both languages. So that is something that we need to consider when we're assessing children who are bilingual.
Are there, bilingual speech therapists in the U.S. that someone would go and see?
Yes, there are speech pathologists who specialize in working with children and adults who are learning second languages.
Okay. We're going to wrap up here for our segment. And we'll take a short break. And when we return, we'll be joined by the Emporia State debate team, who recently became the first team ever to win two national debate titles in the same year. I'd like to thank Carol Koch and Shatonda Jones for joining us today.
Thank you.
And
to Vicki Adair, who was my speech therapist in elementary school. Central Standard returns in just a moment. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Maria Carter, and we're switching topics to debate now. Our guests are Sam Maurer, the Director of Debate at Emporia State University, and Ryan Wash and Elijah Smith, two of his all-star debaters. We're talking about their recent historic win. Ryan and Elijah became the first team ever to win both the CEDA and NDT national debate tournaments. I am not that familiar with the world of debate. What is the difference between those two tournaments?
The difference between those two tournaments is one of them is a completely open invite, so it's got a lot more teams competing at it. This year it was right around 150, the CEDA tournament, that is. And the National Debate Tournament requires qualification through one of three means and only has 78 teams at it every year. So one is prepping for both is a very different experience, but each national tournament kind of brings its own level of challenges to the equation.
And that was Sam Maurer. He's the debate coach at Emporia State University. And Elijah, what kind of competition were you up against in the finals?
In finals of the CEDA, we debated West Georgia. They read from a very in-depth branch of philosophy and critical race literature. And then in finals of the NDT, we debated Northwestern, and they're very oriented towards policy research and discussions about, like, the federal government.
And, you know, Emporia State, were you the Cinderella story, to use the March Madness term of the debate world there?
I suppose so, and I guess we've kind of – that's starting to catch up with us now as it starts to set in that, you know, what just happened. But, yeah, there was a we've really been humbled by the outpouring of support we've seen from all directions, alums that I've never met, folks who have been associated with both the NDT and CETA for years and years that I've looked up to but never spoken to or sending me emails, authors that we read in debates. Were emailing us, so it's really been quite overwhelming the amount of support that we've gotten after accomplishing this.
And if you participated in debate in high school or college, what did you learn from competing? Do you use those skills in your job now? Join the conversation by calling 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888, or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. And Ryan, what's the feeling like when you won that first one and then you won the second one? How does it feel?
The first one, I was definitely surprised and I cried a lot. But the second one, I wasn't expecting to win it. You know, I was still doing what I had to do, knowing that my last debate was coming up at any point in time. So I was just making sure that I performed my best and did my best. But when they announced the decision in the finals of the NDT, the second tournament, I felt like I died but was born again inside.
So just a little excited.
Yeah, just a little bit.
Well, and how did you get involved in debate?
Actually, I won a chess tournament at my high school, which is Central High School here in Kansas City, Missouri. And my debate coach, Jane Reinhardt, who would soon to be my high school debate coach, she came to my classroom, my English 10 class, and said that anybody who could critically think in chess could obviously critically think in debate. And I played her off, and then she changed my schedule after a couple of months of me, you know, blowing her off until I had debate class. And a requirement for debate class was to attend debate tournaments. And once I went to my first tournament, I got hooked.
So you got forced into it, but you liked it.
Yeah, you know.
Tricked, more or less.
Tricked, okay. Well, and Elijah, how'd you get involved?
The librarian, Ms. Rosenbaum, at my high school in Newark, she was... Like, we have funding to send students to debate camp. You just have to attend a few tournaments. And I, like, free camp. I guess I found a hobby.
I think we had a similar approach to high school. you both come from, as I've read, an urban debate background. What is that? And, you know, how does it maybe differ from what people might think of as a more traditional debate background?
I think that urban debate originated from... the recognition that there is structural barriers, especially for minority students, to get inside of debate. And so what a lot of people did was created nonprofit organizations that try to give those kids opportunities that a lot of the prominent kids in America do have in terms of debate. And so now what you have is a conglomeration of leagues all across the United States of America that are comprised mostly of minority students that debate in urban debate leagues who... the goal is for them to be able to learn debate in their location so they could then branch out nationally.
And what are some of those barriers that you mentioned?
Obviously, money is a big issue. Community support, knowledge of what debate is. A lot of times, students don't really care. They don't think of debate as something that they want to do. When they think of debate, they think of suit and ties and presidential debates instead of an activity where they can share their views, perspectives, and opinions about given subjects.
Well, and Sam, debate, it's not like the presidential debates. What is debate like, this competitive debate that people do in high school and college?
Well, I think people have a lot of misperceptions about it because they do think of it as being kind of almost Whiggish, like where we stand up and kind of take opposite sides or disagree about something. It's, you know, judge subjectively and we go home. When, as a matter of fact, it's far closer to a sport than it is a club. People take it very seriously. And I think the team that we defeated in the finals of the NDT embody that, especially Northwestern's work effort at the NDT every year, year in and year out, is emblematic of the level of competitive excellence that every team who competes at the NDT seeks to ascribe to. So debate is a lot more, it's less about the formality and more about very technical speaking and speaking to people who are experts who have been judging debates for 30 years. And they don't need to, you know, as much of the kind of window dressing around arguments as much as they just need the nitty gritty of the arguments. So from an outside perspective, a lot of times it looks very dense and very technical. But that's something that we are actually trying to change a little bit to make debate a little bit more appealing and a little bit less kind of detached from its subject matter and excessively technical.
Well, when you say dense and technical, what do you mean exactly?
I mean, the average debater speaks somewhere between 350 to 400 words per minute. And the setting is more about, like, people don't wear suits and ties typically. Sometimes they do at national tournaments, but it's far more about just the words that you say and their efficacy in regards to the arguments, as opposed to norms about, you know, how you look or how you present yourself or something like that.
So it's really
that.
About talking fast and getting in those points?
Right. And so you see, you know, you look at a debate from an outsider's perspective, it might seem kind of strange, but, you know, people are wearing sweatpants and, you know, sweatshirts and just leaning up against, you know, a podium speaking as fast as they can. And it's really not what you're expecting, but that's because debate is an ultra-competitive, like I said before, kind of more of a sport than it is a club. And people take it very seriously, invest in it heavily at multiple universities.
And you mentioned doing things a little bit differently. What are you all as a team doing differently?
I think that what we do is attempt to incorporate a lot more firsthand perspectives. We engage in what is known as standpoint epistemology. We like to hear stories of violence from the perspective of those who have experienced it instead of trying to get in those who just kind of watch what's going on. We try to get a sense of what things like structural violence feels like, what that looks like on the ground, rather than how it's theorized, if that makes sense.
A little bit. Is it more of a storytelling the background?
It's a political discussion wrapped in storytelling. I wouldn't say that storytelling is separate from the world of politics, but using that as a way to engage politics.
Okay, well, we're going to take a phone call. Melissa from Overland Park, welcome.
Hi, thanks. Well, first of all, I'm a debate mom, so I just have to say congratulations.
Thank you.
I heard that you're going to get honored by the state legislature the way they honor sports teams, and I want to know if there's a date set for that because my son's a huge fan, and I will definitely pull him out of school to go see that.
I want to say that the day, you'll have to excuse me, but we've been scheduling a lot of events very recently, but we'll have it up on our Emporia State University Debate Facebook page as soon as we finalize the itinerary. I want to say that the date is April 17th, if I'm remembering correctly, but like I said, we'll have an official itinerary up, and we very much appreciate your support in that matter.
And well, thanks. I hear this, you know, you said 300, 400 words a minute. Could you example of how that sounds, because it is just crazy.
Elijah.
Elijah's probably the best capable of demonstrating this.
I don't have anything to read.
Just do something.
Oh, but speeding is so cool. All right, thank you.
Sorry, thank you.
Well, 300 words is really fast. I know I write a newscast every morning that's 3.5 minutes long, and it's 550 words. So, you know, to me, that would be a very long newscast if I had to speak that fast. How you two work as a team during these tournaments. How long have you known each other?
I met Ryan for the first time in November at the Wake Forest tournament. I was at Rutgers University, and he was competing. I was competing, so we just kind of said hello, and that was it. And then I ended up at Emporia for the spring.
Did you transfer for debate to Emporia?
I did. That is why I'm hearing with y'all right now in this area.
Well, what makes a good debate partner?
I think a good debate partner is someone that you can kind of you have to be able to argue with your debate partner, and you have to be able to fight and get over it. You have to be able to disagree and then come to conclusions, and you also have to be able to kind of synthesize your thoughts so you can have a coherent explanation throughout the round.
If you competed in high school or college debate, we'd like to hear from you and what you learned. And if you use those skills, maybe synthesizing, disagreeing, and coming to a resolution in your job now, join the conversation by calling 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. And you guys get a new topic each year. What was the topic this time around?
The topic this year was energy production.
And so do you guys take both sides of it? How does that work?
Basically, every debate tournament is a regular season and a playoffs crammed into 3 or 4 days. And so you have preliminary rounds, typically 8 of them, where you'll be affirmative in half of them and negative in half of them. And you have to develop arguments for or against the resolution based on which side you're on. And then when you get to elimination rounds at a tournament, more or less a single elimination playoff system, sometimes flip a coin, sometimes sides are equalized, and then you debate on whichever side gets resolved that way.
Is it easier taking one side of an argument than another sometimes? Or
yeah, it definitely is. There are times when you definitely prefer to be affirmative. It all depends on the situation and the team that you're debating against. There's never really a situation where it's better to be affirmative on the whole topic. It really depends with a wide diversity of competition. Who you want to be affirmative against. For example, in the finals of the NDT, we definitely wanted to be affirmative against Northwestern, especially with the panel that we had. And so we won the coin flip, and we're pretty enthusiastic about that. But yeah, there's definitely side preference, but it's very situational.
Well, one of my questions was, what does a debate coach do? I think you were just talking about it there. It sounds like you've got strategy for different teams. What does some of your job entail?
I do a lot of different things, and I think directors of debate across the country have to wear a variety of different hats. They have to be recruiters. They have to be public relations managers. They have to be argument coaches and all that kind of thing. A lot of what we do has to do with just kind of talking through strategies, using intelligence based on the wiki, which is an open case list where everyone in the country's arguments are documented according to their citations and the exact context of the arguments. We spend a lot of time in the FLOM room on Emporia State University's campus just mapping out ideas on a chalkboard. We watch film of previous debates and our competitors and analyze it and kind of figure out where they're coming from, where they might go. And I think a big chunk of coaching debate as well is argument anticipation, because you can't really know and can't coach once a debate starts. So you just kind of have to predict what's going to happen. And that's one thing that I think all of us, Christopher Laugry, myself, Ryan, and Elijah, have all been good at doing, is developing a good teaching rapport to where immediately before debates we can anticipate and prepare our team even for the unexpected.
I'm thinking that's, Ryan, where your chess skills come in.
I think so.
Okay, well, let's go to a caller. Joe in Lenexa, good morning.
Hi. I was a 4-year debater in high school and felt like it's been an instrumental part in where I am in life today, teaching me logic and topicality and inherency and relevancy. But I was a little shocked, at least in the 1970s when I was in high school, a lot of debate was speech giving and framing your argument and communicating it. And we wore suits and we stood up straight behind the podium and we were taught to have good eye contact. And I was a little shocked that apparently debate has evolved to wearing sweatpants and leaning on the podium and rapid fire language as opposed to effectively, logically presenting your argument.
Well, debate has changed quite a bit, and I think not always to the satisfaction of folks who have been in the activity for as long as you have and who have a history with it. And I think it's easy to, look at what's happening now and think less of it because of how much it has changed. But a couple of things. First of all, although debate is very fast and very technical, the ability to think and talk that fast about very complex forms of research from diverse sources of academia that quickly just equips students to think so fast and so technically There's really nothing like it. For example, I've never really spoken to a debater who debated for 4 years and had a lot of difficulty with law school because of the type of intensity of research and thinking that they have to do. And the other thing, I think that you are rightfully concerned about the direction of debate being a lot less about being persuasive and capturing ethos, pathos, and logos in a debate and really convincing people in front of you. And I think that's a lot of what grounds our success, is that we're trying to bring debate back home, back to persuasion, back to convincing a judge in front of you that you are correct, as opposed to just reading the correct combination of words from a speech document.
If I could ask a follow-up question, I don't know how many words a minute I spoke when I was in debate. And a rapid-fire pace of 350, 400 words a minute. Like I said, I don't know how that compares to how many words a minute I spoke. But do you have any problem with the judges being able to keep up?
Not really, because the human brain, there have been studies to demonstrate the human brain can understand up to 500 words per minute, and most debaters are well below that by quite a bit. And the other thing to keep in mind is that it, in most instances anyway, it's not just a steady, monotonous, you know, droll of 400 words per minute. There is inflection and techniques for programming differences between when you're reading a piece of evidence from an author or when you're making arguments on your own. And even in debates that are very fast, typically last rebuttals tend to slow down quite a bit and usually be, I would guess, more around 250 to 300 words per minute when they have to really break things down. I'm sure you remember that.
Okay, well, Joe, we're going to get a little example here. I'm going to go ahead and let you off the line because we're going to have Elijah read the Gettysburg Address for us at his breakneck speed.
Do you want the whole Gettysburg?
Well, how about we just get 15 seconds or so. I'll wave like this, and okay. We can call it off.
47 years ago, our father brought forth this kind of new nation, conceived liberty, and dedicated to proposition, all men credit equal, now they engage, graceful war, that's when the nation or any nation can see that they can long endure. We are in the great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate important that field, its final resting place for those who are here, otherwise the nation might live altogether fitting and proper that we should do this, but in a large sense.
Okay, I think that is good, and that is a lot of words. That is really fast. How'd you learn to do that?
Practice. And you usually read it a couple times before you go into the debate.
Mm-hmm.
And usually just the evidence is read that quickly because the judges can ask for that evidence afterwards. But if you're just speaking to them, you know, usually slow down.
So that's just to kind of get the facts that you're going to use in your arguments out there.
Right.
Yeah, and it's also a in some measure a kind of defensive measure for us because the competition is going to go fast and they're going to have a lot of arguments and we simply have to keep up in a lot of instances.
I'm still amazed that you can do that. I will just put that out there. I'm a person that I think reading out loud to me it takes a certain pace. It's almost easier to do it a little bit slower than fast like that. So I am in awe.
Thank you.
What have you two learned, you know, from debate? What skills have those carried over either to your personal life or academic life?
I think debate gave me a voice. And what I mean by that is before I joined debate, I was unsure of how to tell people what I wanted or how I felt or anything. I was unable to articulate myself. And I think that debate provided me the skills of not only articulation, but being able to articulate myself to a diverse group of people. You know, you have to talk to people and their experiences. You know, you have to connect to people and get to their soul, their shande, if you will. And so I think that that's a unique thing that debate gave me. And I think that's the portable skill that I will be able to apply to the rest of my life.
And Elijah?
I think debate gives me a way to be academic without being kind of a student in school. I don't really like classroom settings. I think that debate has allowed me to get internships and to work jobs that I probably wouldn't have been able to get because I can express myself and I can engage in whatever subject matter people present me with. And debate just gives you a way to break that down, to contextualize it, and also to apply it to anything that you're learning in the moment.
And this seems like something that's very time intensive. How many hours a week do you all spend practicing and researching and doing all the other things involved in this?
About 30. It's a part-time job. And unless you're at a debate tournament, like when we were at the national tournaments, we spent 71 and a half hours debating.
Wow. That is that is a little more than overtime, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, is it ever a challenge to keep up with schoolwork and do debate?
Always.
Absolutely.
Although I will say at Emporia, we put a heavy emphasis, like if any of them ever tell me, like, I need, you know, time off because I have a test tomorrow and I have to study, I don't ask questions. And I think that's true of most directors in the country, is that, you know, students, for them, school must be a priority. We don't want to just make great debaters who don't graduate. We want to catapult our students into careers afterwards.
Well, and it seems like a skill that might carry over well to most academic situations. If, you know, writing
Absolutely.
A paper, for instance,
Absolutely.
You're probably halfway there. If you can read 300 words a minute, I'm guessing you can, you know, get that paper knocked out pretty quickly.
Absolutely.
Well, what's next for you two?
Ryan Walsh is going to go to grad school. I haven't made an announcement of where I'll be going yet, but that announcement will be made soon, and I'll make sure that Sam puts it up on the Emporia State University debate page.
It may well start with, I'll be taking my talents to blank.
Does debate continue on in grad school?
Well, actually, there is no more debate for me. I am just going to teach other students how to debate and become one of those judges who watch other kids debate and give them feedback. So I'm done with my debater days.
Yeah, okay. And Elijah?
I don't know. I'm figuring out, you know, how much I want to debate, you know, where my argumentative interests will lie. You know, after you've won some national championships, you got to reconsider. I still have eligibility left. So the next 2 years are part of figuring out, you know, what are my extracurricular activities? What does that look like?
And so I'm sure Sam is saying in his head, I hope it's still debating.
Debate will always have a part.
Okay.
I hope it's right for Elijah. I don't too much mind what he does. I just like the kid and hope he lands somewhere that's good for him.
Okay. Well, our guests today were Sam Maurer, the director of debate at Emporia State University, and Ryan Walsh and Elijah Smith. Ryan, we're waiting for that announcement there. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Maria.
You can subscribe to our podcast, hear this conversation again, or access any of our previous shows from the Central Standard page of KCUR.org. Tune in tomorrow as we explore changing ways we conceptualize working with disabilities. Our show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton. Up to Date is next with the conversation with columnist Ellen Goodman about end-of-life issues. I'm Maria Carter, and this is Central Standard.